Welcome to Careertals. This week, efficiency versus effectiveness, part two. The questions this cast answers are, what is the difference between efficiency and effectiveness, and which one is better? Hiring is more difficult than ever. Not only is there a shortage of the right kind of people with the right kind of skills, despite all the layoffs you've heard about, a lot of those people are going to be working remotely, at least some of the time, and the hiring is going to be done remotely, at least some of the time. We're starting a virtual effective hiring manager, a virtual training of effective hiring on the 4th of April. And we'd love to see you there so that we can help you with this new reality. Go to manager-tools.com/training. You'll find all of the details there.
The next part of this cast, we're going to talk about optimizing for effectiveness. The list of examples at the beginning of this guidance all can be categorized as less efficient. That's why we added them onto the list. However, we recommend them because they're more effective than the more efficient alternatives. The few following topics that we cover, we're going to kind of expand on some of them, should give you a good understanding of why we make the recommendations that we do. So the first example that we talked about was making a phone call instead of sending an email. Sending an email takes a few minutes of your time, right? You probably even have some shortcuts or some automatic rules set up that make sending emails more efficient, right? Maybe you have keyboard shortcuts that prompt, you know, text expanders or snippets or things like that, right? And that can make sending that email much more efficient. 90% of the time, sending an email is both the most efficient and the most effective form of communication. But there are instances where it isn't. For example, if it's urgent, you wouldn't send an email. And I love the example that Wendy has in the show notes. You wouldn't send an email to 911, would you? Right? You pick up the phone, you call.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. I don't even know if 911 has an email address, but it makes no sense to send them an email, that's for sure.
No, it doesn't. I think I heard a story about some local 911 or emergency operators doing or experimenting with chat functions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh boy, I don't know if I like where that's headed. I don't know. It worries me.
If you're somewhere in danger and you can't talk, you know, being able to email or chat
makes
a lot of sense.
That's a great point.
It does.
Yeah, because then you don't
have
to do the call and order a pizza thing and try to decipher the code.
Yeah,
that's a great point.
But you know, if you have a plumbing emergency in your house, it's not quite the same thing. But you wouldn't email a plumber. You would go Google and start phoning people because you want an instant answer. Urgency means phone calls.
Right. Exactly. What if the other person, you know that they're not likely to read the email or, based on your experience with them, to not respond? Then sending an email is not going to be the most effective method of communication.
Yeah, there's no point in beating a dead horse, as they say. Like, if you know that somebody doesn't answer their emails, but they do answer texts, send them a text. Or if they answer their phone and they talk, then phone them.
Right. Or if what you're sending an email about is too complex or complicated or just something that would be better served talking on the phone, right?
Something that would need a lot of back and forth sometimes, especially if you're trying to explain it. Sometimes if you're trying to explain something, you think, oh, it would be better if I could just go through it step by step and I could write the right words down. But what happens is people have questions about things that you haven't included. And so if you're on the phone and they say, oh, but what about this? You think, oh, I never would have included that because I don't understand why that's a question, but okay. And then you answer it. It's much faster.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the other thing is, if you've already sent an email and a follow-up, sending another email is not going to achieve what you're looking for. We have podcasts on that. Don't send another email.
Potentially, a phone call takes more time than writing an email. Like, we'll admit to that. And it's fraught with risk. Like, you don't have the perfect wording or you don't have a record afterwards. Mm-hmm. But the goal is not to send an email. That's not the object of this exercise. It's not the outcome that you want is not having sent an email. It's not I've broadcast the message. It's having the message heard and acted upon. Mm-hmm. Okay? If sending 10 emails would have the same effect as one phone call, then one phone call is more efficient than the first 9 emails. It's quicker overall, but you know, it's less efficient in the moment, but it's more effective overall.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think everybody, it seems like we're telling, the English phrase is telling your grandmother to suck eggs, which means telling people to do something that's so obvious that you wouldn't need to tell them how to do it. Not that I've ever sucked an egg. But I think we can easily convince ourselves, oh, I'll just send another email because it's efficient or it won't take a couple of minutes, and not think, okay, what am I actually trying to achieve here, and taking the bigger picture.
And sometimes it's just, it's convenient for me right now. It's convenient for me to send an email, right?
Or I don't want to talk about this subject. And so I'm going to send an email and avoid having a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're all human.
Totally. Some of us. So another example would be, I mentioned handwriting notes in meetings, even though we know you can type more quickly than you can write. And, you know, some of you can't read your own handwriting, but I mean, most of us can type more quickly than we can write. I think, you know, most of us are at that point now. And many people say that their handwriting looks like chicken scratch. That's what I hear all the time. Chicken scratch. So why would I take the slower or less efficient route? Well, there's a few reasons. Number one is typing leads to less effective recall. And you may say, well, but you know, that's not that important. Well, let's think of what the purpose of taking notes is, right? This is where we need to broaden our lens a little bit and think, why are we taking notes? Is it so that we can have a, you know, complete full record transcript of what happened? No, not necessarily, right? Ideally, taking notes is helping us cement this information into our brain, because when we find ourselves, you know, 2 weeks from now, having to make decisions based on the information that we gathered in this meeting, we may not have the ability or the time or the capacity to refer back to our notes. And ideally, as much as we can, that information was absorbed so that we can action it.
And sometimes even it's just like a tickle of like, there was something about that thing was on the right-hand page near the top.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how our brain stores information. Our brain stores information in terms of pictures, not in terms of words, right? So when we are handwriting notes, exactly to Wendy's point, sometimes it could be, oh yeah, I remember writing something about that. It was in the, and the more you can kind of piece the images together in your brain, then you can get to the information without having to actually refer back to your notes. You go, oh yeah, it was in the top right-hand corner. I remember because I was writing this along the left and that stood out so much. I put it over on the right in the corner. I wanted to remember it. And now I remember it was this, right? So the other thing that your brain kind of compartmentalizes as you're taking notes is emotions, right? Our brains are really good at remembering how we felt in a certain moment or the emotion that that was linked to a certain experience. And no one gets emotional or ties emotions to words typed on pages. Like it just doesn't happen, right? So that the linkage in our brain to handwritten notes is much more likely to happen when we write it down and we have that, you know, more kinetic experience.
Another one, typing is a barrier in communication to the other people in the room. If you're using a laptop, there's obvious the screen is between you and them. And yes, you're tall enough to see over the top of it, but you're looking down. Even if you can touch type, and actually people who can touch type and look at you while they're typing, that freaks people out, because I can do that and I can look out the window and type at the same time and it freaks people out. So actually looking at them while they're talking and typing, people don't like that.
I actually had an experience with this small, silly experience way back when I was in college. So years ago, there was a student in the class. He would sit near the front and he didn't bring a laptop, but what he had was a Bluetooth keyboard connected to his phone. And so he would pull out, it was a foldable keyboard. He would sit in the front row. He would pull out a keyboard and set it on the desk and type as the instructor is talking. But there's no other device. There's just a keyboard. The instructor, after the first, I think he let him do it for like two sessions, two lectures. And he was like, this is freaking me out. The fact that you, like, how do you know what you're typing is accurate? How do you, and then we had a 10-minute aside, you know, tangent in the lecture because he couldn't handle, his brain couldn't handle this guy typing, but not having a screen or anything, right? And so even when you feel like you're eliminating barriers, you could be creating more of a barrier.
Yeah, and it's weird that it literally does not matter whether there's a screen or not, right? Because it doesn't matter whether I'm typing with a screen or I'm typing without a screen or I'm handwriting notes. I could still be writing absolutely anything. And it had nothing to do with the meeting. I could be writing my grocery list. And you can't tell the difference. And yet, somehow, there is a qualitative difference in the experience for the other people in the room. It's just weird.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And, you know, people just don't believe that you're listening to them when you're typing, in the same way that they believe that you're listening to them when you're handwriting notes. And like I say, I can't explain that psychologically, but I know it's true.
Absolutely.
Maybe this is it. People think of handwritten notes as temporary memory joggers and type notes as record keeping. Like type notes are for the record and handwritten notes are just, oh, so I remember later. It's a much more casual thing. It's a much more transient thing. So maybe that's why it feels different to other people.
And I think part of that is that handwriting thing, right? If I can't read my own handwriting, certainly no one else is going to be able to read it, right? So it's encoded, so to speak. But if I'm typing notes, it's almost like I am taking these notes in a way that I know other people will be able to read.
True.
Whereas if I'm writing them, that seems like it's more just for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's weird. So typing may be efficient, but it's not effective.
Exactly.
We are coming to Austin, April 18th and 19th to deliver our Effective Manager Conference and our Effective Communicator Conference. We love coming to Austin, where all the hip people live. And if you are a member of the Project Management Institute and you need your continuing education credits, we have just become an approved training provider, which means that your professional development units are now pre-approved. All you have to do is submit them once you've been to the training and you will get those hours. So come see us in Austin, April 18th and 19th. Just come to our website and look for training.
Our next example is giving all of your direct reports 30 minutes each week to talk about anything they want, even when you've got better things to do.
This is my favorite.
Yeah. So we recommend at Manager Tools, one-on-ones be 30 minutes, occur every week, and be scheduled on your calendar and on their calendar. And the direct goes first. And this is an important part. They get to talk about anything they want to talk about, even if that's puppies and rainbows. And we recommend every manager have one-on-ones. In companies where staff work billable time, That is, you know, every minute that they work for a client is billed to that client. There's a direct link between the work the staff do and the bottom line of the company. Even in those companies, we recommend that managers sacrifice 30 minutes of their time and billings to a meeting with their direct. And often, it's really hard to convince managers to do that.
Utilization. Billings.
Oh, yeah.
What do you want me to do? Make money or talk to my directs? Both.
And the answer is yes. Right. So it's the direct's chance to talk about issues that are preventing them working most efficiently, right? It's the manager's chance to steer their direct to maximum efficiency over the coming week. It's the equivalent of servicing your vehicle, getting that oil change, getting the fluids topped off, right? Doing all the stuff, because everything runs better after you've had a one-on-one. And this is where I think a lot of managers that not struggle, but maybe push back on this concept, it's the same thing that we've been talking about. It's a question of effectiveness versus efficiency. And they often, I think, conflate one-on-ones with other meetings that they've seen or they've had in the past with either their boss or their directs. And they think these meetings are meetings that are designed to be an update, be a status, right? And those types of things. But what I try to get people to understand when I'm teaching people about one-on-ones is the desired outcome of a one-on-one is not efficiency, is not about getting the most done. It's about getting results, of course. Results come first and foremost, but also retaining people. And it's hard to retain people if you don't know them. And you don't know them if all you ever talk about is what you want to talk about.
Yes.
The work, the stuff that you want to get done, the way you want to drive results and get things done. You've got to also open up and let them talk. And we say 30 minutes, but really the agenda is 10, 10, 10. So what you're really sacrificing is 10 minutes per direct per week for their issues and their stuff that they want to talk about. And that's not a lot. And if you're thinking, well, I mean, gosh, I mean, there's just so much stuff that I want to cover. You're the boss. You can cover the stuff you want to talk about anytime you want, right? That's one of the privileges of, yes, you know, getting promoted. But they don't have that same ability. And directs who get a few minutes every week to express, you know, what's going on in either their work or their life, there's no right answer there. It's whatever they want to talk about. They report better relationships with their managers. And better relationships with their managers means that they leave less.
And that's that long-term thing again of, you know, like you put in that investment and then that person stays and you don't have to have the hit to efficiency of that person leaving and hiring someone new and teaching them how to do it and having that long time of like when they're not at the standard that you want them to and all that stuff. So a big picture, you know. And some people say, oh, well, I'll do it with the people that are struggling, but I don't want to do it with the people that are great because they don't need managing. To which I would say, this is the equivalent of stopping for gas. You have to stop sometime for gas if you're doing a really long car trip. Like, you can't just keep driving because eventually you run out of gas. And you have to stop for gas whether you're driving a Ford or a Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. So you have to gas up a car. No, or stop for electric, I guess, now.
Yeah, that's the new thing now.
And
yeah.
Power up. And it doesn't matter what kind. So all directs all the time.
Yep, all directs all the time. So giving your direct 30 minutes of your time is similar to what we've talked about in terms of doing things that take you longer to make other people's jobs easier. When considered independently, it makes no sense to make yourself less efficient. And many people stop there. When we consider the whole, though, right, when we consider what we're trying to achieve, that's where something like a one-on-one helps you both reach the goal and use the minimum total amount of resources to get there. So reaching the goal using the bare minimum, absolute, you know, least amount of resources is not effective if it means that those resources have to come elsewhere, either from other people or from other places down the chain in terms of the work. And if I really have time, or if I'm dealing with someone one-on-one and we're talking about whether or not they can do one-on-ones and do them weekly and do them for 30 minutes and all of that stuff, I'll ask, well, when was the last time you had an opening on the team? And they say, when? And then I start to unpack how much of your time was spent on finding a replacement, the recruiting, the interviewing, the training, the onboarding, the talking to other people on the team because they feel overloaded or overwhelmed because they're picking up the slack of the one person that's missing. All of that time, you cannot cast that aside. Mm-hmm. That's time that's spent. And when we total that up, we get to a lot of time. We get to sometimes 70, 80 hours spent on replacing someone, getting someone up to speed. And guess what? That person is less productive, less efficient than the person who was there before. And so that time, when you unpack it, I go, well, you know, that was, if we divide by 30 minutes, right? Maybe that's 6-7 months of one-on-ones. Would you have rather just done 30 minutes a week and saved yourself? Because guess what? With a 30-minute one-on-one, if something comes up, you can move it around in the week, mm-hmm. right? Our data shows that there's no impact to results and retention or trust scores when we move the meeting within the week. But when someone leaves, you don't have the luxury of being able to move those things around. And I mean, you've got urgency now. You've got to do some of those activities.
Someone else is dictating the timetable.
Exactly. Yeah.
This reminded me, just as you were talking, another analogy that maybe this will be helpful, maybe not. You often see in like the financial papers or the papers that cover businesses that there has been a change in businesses' strategy since they've had to start reporting numbers quarterly. And some of the businesses have stopped doing so because they're driven to the quarterly numbers, and achieving their quarterly numbers means that they act in a way that's short-term to keep those numbers up rather than investing in long-term projects. And that's kind of like this. It's because you're looking at what's going to happen in the next week and you're thinking, I need that half an hour. You're not thinking about what's going to happen in the next year and the 40, 50, 100 hours you're going to lose recruiting. Or you're thinking about what's going to happen in the next 10 minutes and that phone call and versus the email versus what would happen in the next 3 weeks and the hour you're going to lose because you have to explain this thing four times because the email didn't work or whatever.
Yeah. I'm not positive, but I think working for Manager Tools is the first time in, gosh, at least 15, 20 years that I haven't worked for a publicly traded company. And I remember every publicly traded company, there was a certain level of time spent at almost all levels of talking about shareholders, talking about stock price, talking about, you know, earnings calls, quarterly earnings, right? How do things work? You know, how do they look? How do we position so that, you know, it shows that we're working operationally on the things that, you know, we're
addressed as, care about.
Yeah, exactly. And it's refreshing to work now in a place where, you know, obviously we don't have to worry about that stuff. We can focus more on long-term. How do we, and here's the interesting thing. When you're focused on all that stuff that, you know, I was talking about at publicly traded companies, sometimes it's easy to lose sight of what are we really trying to do and achieve here? And, you know, that's one of the things I love about working here is that we're laser focused on every manager effective, every professional productive.
Okay, we'll give them one more example.
All right.
So this is another of my favorites. I did all my favorites and examples. Talk to people before you present to them and tell them what you're going to present, which we call pre-wiring.
Yeah.
When you're creating a presentation to persuade a group of people to take a specific course of action, It makes most sense to spend the most amount of time you can on the presentation. If you take a simple inputs-outputs view, the presentation you make is the input and the output is the decision, right? It's you going into the room, it's the PowerPoint that you put up, it's the words you say that makes the decision happen, and either happens the way you want it to or it doesn't. And the better the presentation, the more likely it is that you get the outcome you want. So everybody who's avoiding doing this, including me sometimes, uses this logic to tinker with their PowerPoints, just like center that word and change the font and so on. And we just tweak the text and we go and choose just the right image until it's absolutely perfect. And that's the wrong way to do it.
Yeah, we recommend that you take a pre-perfect PowerPoint and show it to decision makers ahead of time. Ask them for their input. And this is more work, for sure. And this results in changes that you need to make to the PowerPoint, and maybe even sometimes reversing changes that you've already made and changes you thought were really good, right? And this is not efficient. However, it is effective because when we go into the room after having done that and we present, we already have the room or the people in that room on our side. We know what their concerns are and we can address them. And when it comes to making a decision, the time invested in pre-wiring means the output is virtually guaranteed. Right?
There's no doubt, because you already know what the five people in that room are thinking through every single slide.
It reminds me of that old saying, it's better to be lucky than good.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think, sometimes maybe misunderstand that. The reason it's better to be lucky is because, by definition, if you're lucky, it's a good outcome.
Yes.
Right? You can be skilled and still get negative outcomes.
Yes.
Right? In this scenario, right, you may pre-wire with someone and they may not like what you have to say. You know, it may be an uncomfortable conversation, but that's an uncomfortable conversation with just them and you that you can then use to head them off or you know, get ahead of their concerns in the larger presentation, right?
So, yeah, wouldn't you rather have that conversation in private?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because that's going to that is more likely to guarantee the outcome you want from the presentation.
For sure. Efficiency sounds like it should be our goal. Should I be efficient? Yes. And for machines, it often is the outcome that we want. But for people, it's better to be less efficient and more effective. Even if you strive to be the unemotional, rational, data-driven kind of person, the people around you are not. You can base your work on those principles, but you'll find in short order that other people mess with your efficiency calculations. It's not fair, but they do. So instead, widen your view, think about the bigger picture, and think about what you can do now to make the longer term, whether that longer term is the next week or the next hour or the next year, more effective. More efficient over the long term is more effective, and that's more successful over the long term. And that's what you're striving for, right?
Yeah, I think there's a chance that some people listen to this whole podcast and say, Andrew and Wendy, what if the desired outcome is to be efficient? To which I would say, well, then just ask one more question. Why do we want to be efficient in this or in that or whatever we're talking about? And that will give you the answer of really what you want to achieve or accomplish.
Keep asking why. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Wendy.
That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with a new topic.
Bye, everyone.